Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayigash. This week, Rabbi Daniel Landes discusses Vayigash. Rabbi Daniel Landes is the director of the Pardes Institute. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you, Larry. This parsha, Vayigash, like the former parshios, just chock full of everything that one would want in a story. But this is really starts with a bang. And I'd like to speak of the different levels of how one verse works. Well, it's really more than one verse, but we'll emphasize one verse. Almost even two words, but maybe even one word. Let me do the verse, the very first verse. Vayigash elav Yehuda, vayomer bi Adoni, yedaber no avdecha davor bazne Adoni, vayichar apecha b'avdecha, ki kamocha kifaro, or ki chamocha kifaro. So Yehuda approached him being the vizier, second to the king, Yosef, and said, Be Adoni. We'll translate it now as please my master. Let your servant please speak a matter in the ear of my master. And do not be upset, do not be angered with your servant, for you are as Pharaoh. There's three levels I'd like to deal with in this verse, and at this point, the Yehuda, who has approached, takes the other steps metaphorically, and speaks many things to Pharaoh, and makes his plea, and maybe even stronger than a plea to Pharaoh. So I'd like to speak first on the strategic level. How things look and how things were done, the strategic level of what Yehuda is doing, what Judah, Yehuda is doing. And then I'd like to speak about the backstory, the identity politics of what's going on, the relational levels, all that is there, but I'll call it now identity politics. And then I want to speak on the existential level. Three levels, strategic, identity politics, existential. We'll start with the first. And the first is what it looks like on the outside, or how we would stage it, how the play would take place. Yehuda goes for broke. Things are in a terrible situation. Yosef, the vizier, they don't know it's Yosef. Yosef has decided now that he's maneuvered Benjamin, to be the last of the sons, his indeed, his brother, not a half-brother, but a full brother, both from Rachel, from Rachel, and from Yaakov, from Jacob. He's maneuvered him to Egypt. He's keeping him after he has framed him for a transgression, for stealing, and he's a framed person. And he's going to keep him. And Yehuda knows he's got to bring the boy home. He's promised his father, and his father will just kill his father. And Yehuda approaches. And the question is how to take this approach. He throws himself in the inner circle. Many of the commentators explain that surrounding Yosef were, of course, the bodyguards and all forms of officials, and that Yosef had that complete, well-armed, very strong entourage. And when the brothers spoke beforehand, when Yehuda was speaking beforehand, they spoke outside of that circle. And to throw yourself into the circle is going for broke, because no one is supposed to get that close to a person who is the second in command, but in effect, the person in command of Egypt. And what Yehuda is actually doing, as he throws himself in, and this last gasp attempt, this going for broke, but I see is that he's getting himself out of the circle of victimhood. He is moving out of a passive response. Or a non-response, in fact. He is taking himself in a very daring type of act. He's throwing himself in. And if you say, well, is he really outside of that circle of victimhood and now he's throwing himself into the inner circle? Well, that you may say, well, that doesn't sound right. That maybe he's even more of a victim inside. I don't think so. He is putting himself in front of Yosef's face. He's looking at him eye to eye. That is leaving the circle of victimhood and going into the inner circle. But secondly, and as dramatic as the approach, Vayigash, throwing himself in, is what he does with what he speaks. He says, I want to speak into your ear. So it's a private conversation. Forget everyone else around. This is man to man. We're speaking eye to eye. This is upfront and dangerous. And as he does it, he seizes the narrative. He seizes the narrative and tells the story over. Yehuda says, this is what happened. We came innocent. We came innocent. We are innocent. We've told you everything about our father. We've told you about a missing brother. You know who Benjamin is, that he's the only one left to our father. And we've told you what this would do to our father, and we go through, and he speaks very directly, and he also says what he's ready to do, which is, of course, to take Benjamin's place. I say, of course, it's not really of course. That's quite an act. So he seizes the narrative. He controls the narrative. He does not accept any of these ideas that they are subversives as Yosef originally stated. And he says that the whole notion of being thieves is ridiculous. He emphasizes exactly what happened, and he emphasizes what will take place if he cannot return Binyamin. So that's the first side. This is Yehuda in the matter of speaking truth to power. He's speaking truth to power, and there's no one more powerful than the head of Egypt in those days. And Yehuda becomes that truthful person. And there's an assumption here, which I think is a terrific and in some way a wondrous assumption that Yehuda makes, and that is that vizier, who's so powerful, is actually a moral being. He's speaking truth to power. He's not speaking power to power. He's speaking truth to power with the assumption that the one who commands the power can hear. There's a reason why I'm on the inside, because there's something you need to hear. I've come into the circle. I've left the circle of victimhood. I'm now in the circle of power. I'm not as a powerful person, but as a truthful person. You need to hear this. I now will explain the narrative and not be reactive. I will explain the narrative. And the assumption of the vizier, the second command, Yosef, being this moral personage, I think it's very attractive, could be convincing. I believe that Yehuda actually believes that, and that itself is a transformative act. Three transformative motives: getting out of the circle of victimhood, getting inside, seizing the narrative, and making the assumption that those in power can hear morality when explained properly, can hear the truth. That's stage one. That's kind of his strategic moment. And therefore, when he says be, and he says na, both in the first words, when he says please, and he says no, which sometimes it means please, is emphatic. He is saying, you need to hear this, and I'm going to say it to you. Do not take personal offense, God forbid. The second stage, or second dimension, is this identity politics. It's the backstory. When he's approaching, what's happened since he's approached, or before he's approached, what's happened? And what you have in the story, and I'm sure, dear listener, you will come up with things that I either skipped, forgot, or never thought of about the interesting crossing of identities. First of all, we're all in the game that from the 12 brothers, the 12 sons of Jacob, that the early taking of Shimon and imprisoning of Shimon was a way of identifying Shimon's experience with that of Yosef. Indeed, the brothers themselves understand their momentary imprisonment, it was just for a short period of time, and seemingly understand Shimon's imprisonment as a complete parallel to what happened with Yosef and what they did to Yosef. And therefore, Shimon is identified with Yosef, not the Yosef the vizier, but the Yosef, the younger, weaker, annoying brother. And Shimon is put aside. Of course, the vizier, Yosef, knows very well to, if you pick Shimon, a rabble-rouser, a tough guy, someone to be afraid of, and put him aside is, of course, a very smart move. And what's even smarter is making sure that Levi, his accomplice in the revenge for Dinah's honor, that Levi would not be part of the group, but the group of one, would not join Shimon. So anyway, there's Shimon, who's already gone through the early Yosef experience. And then, of course, there's Binyamin. He is for sure identified also with Yosef. The two of them are the only two children of Rachel and of Yaakov. And they are very much the same. And Binyamin, with Yosef's departure, Binyamin is the youngest brother and is functionally the youngest brother. And more than that, he is a person who's referred to in relationship to his father in the same terms that Yosef was to his father, Ben Zakunim, a son of his old age, or perhaps an old son. He was old beyond his years. Or Ben Zakunim, which was said about Yosef, that Yosef was a Ben Zakunim because he looked just like his old man. He looked just like Yaakov. So he was a Ben Zakunim, and here Binyamin's a Ben Zakunim. Any one of these three kind of possibilities, son of the old age, which for sure is the case, or that he was a wise son, or that he looked like his dad, any one of these, certainly the first one and the other two in any combination, one, two, or three of these factors make him just like his brother Yosef. So Binyamin, being the youngest son, is just like Yosef. And another term is used regarding him when Yehuda talks about Binyamin, Vayivater lo levado. He's the only one left alone to his father and his mother Rachel, and indeed Jacob loves him. Vayivater lo levado. He is left alone. He's a lonely person, which of course is the term we know about Yaakov, that the famous night when he wrestled with the angel, Vayivaser Yaakov levado, and Yaakov was left alone. And certainly that's a character and a trait that Yosef had over all these years, being sent as a imprisoned slave in lowest level of society, the years he spent imprisoned in Egypt, even when he was in a royal, or I say a powerful position in the house of Potiphar, not royal, but powerful position. He was on his own. He was subject to all sorts of problematics, and then again into prison. And we see in Kings of Royalty many people surrounding him, but he's still left alone. Both Benjamin, Binyamin, and indeed Yosef have this notion of being left alone. They are both B'nai Zikunim, children, old children, children of the old age, miniature Jacobs. And now, of course, Binyamin, who now has to be by himself, alone in a new way with this vizier, not knowing that it's Yosef, with this vizier. This is a terrible situation that, in many ways, models the situation that Yosef was in. And again, Binyamin, in many ways, is Yosef. And then, finally, there's another similarity. I said that Shimon was Yosef, that Binyamin was Yosef. In certain ways, in this clash, this Vayigash Elav, and he approached to him, the other being Yosef, is not so much other. Yehuda and Yosef are very comparable. Both are leaders. We saw that Yosef was really, with that coat of many colors, was put in a situation that even though he was the youngest of the sons, not including Binyamin, he's the youngest of the sons, he is the one who's going to take over. He was the one who was going to place Reuven, who maybe had good intentions, but Reuven, who on so many different levels did not act properly. Reuven, who really can't do it. Reuven, who's described as Pachas Kamayim, he's as stable as a glass of water. In other words, not too stable. And Yosef takes over for him. And then when Yosef is out of the picture, it's clear that no matter what Reuven has to say, it is Yehuda that's running the show. And so both Yosef and Yehuda became the potential of being the first amongst all the brothers. And indeed, before it was conclusively determined that all the brothers would inherit, all the brothers would be part of this covenant, all the brothers would take over, still the first amongst equals, if we can borrow a expression from another religion, just as the Pope is the first amongst equals of all the other heads of churches within the universal church, Catholic Church, as it were, so too, preceding them, Yosef and Yehuda were candidates, at the very least, of being first amongst equals. And there's other things that are close with them. Both had a sexual crisis in their relationships, and that's Yehuda with Tamar. Both experienced defeat. Yehuda had to say about Tamar, Tzadka mimeni, more righteous than me. Both went through, and Yosef was left with tremendous embarrassment in the hands of the wife of Potiphar. Both were stripped of their identity. Yosef's coat was stripped from him. A second time, his coat was stripped from him. And this by the wife of Potiphar, when he, in the end, and you can see that the ambivalence in the verses, when he, in the end, refused the advances. And Tamar held all the identifying marks, the staff, and all the talismans that belonged to Yehuda, the equivalent of his credit card and his password. She held that, and both of them had that type of experience, and both were terrific business people, Yehuda running the clan, Yosef running the economics of his country. And so, therefore, in this identity politics, when Yehuda, when he goes to Yosef, as much as possible, it's a clash of almost evenly matched titans. And we should add that all those extra years that Yehuda had with his father, Yaakov, must only have been a greater blessing for that moment. So we've talked right now on the strategic level, and we've spoken right now on the identity politics level. Let's just now go to the existential level. And here I am helped by one comment of the Or HaChaim, who said that Yehuda's task was to win over Yosef. And it says, Mayim el Mayim. They're just like water reflecting water. And this is the direction that they needed to go in. And Yehuda had to win him over, had to win Yosef over. And I think after the Maim, El Maim continues the note that I said before about identity politics, even stronger existentially. And that is, Yehuda had to show who he is. He had to understand who he himself had to understand who he is. And he had to somehow open himself up so that this vizier would open himself up. The vizier opened himself up. Boy, did he open himself up. Remember what Yehuda, how Yehuda speaks and who Yehuda was. Yehuda was this businessman. Bab Betza, well, what is our profit? What profit is there, he said to the brothers when they were about to kill Yosef. What's the profit? Let's sell him as a slave. Of course, this is a way of saving him. But it reflects very much the practical notion of Yehuda. When Yehuda speaks to his father and says, we have to take Binyamin down to Egypt, he speaks to speaks to his father Yaakov in very practical terms. It's that. It's not going to work any other way. This is what has to be. It's going to happen anyway. Let's not waste any more time. In fact, Yaakov becomes practical, too. He says, okay, take some dates and figs and other things from this country as a gift. They both get very practical. And as a practical thing, Yehuda promises to bring him back and promises in a very practical way to his father. It doesn't sound like an emotional conversation. And when he speaks to Yosef, you know, he speaks practically, too. He tells over the story. He tells what happened. He talks almost as, in the end, as even the brothers being fungible. I'll take his place. What's the difference? We're all brothers. You know, this Benjamin needs to be back. Let's make the deal. So the question is, in terms of the stalemate, who is going to break down first? And Vayita Pek, you may say Yosef broke down first. He couldn't take it anymore. He sends everyone away. He gives a great cry. But I say that actually it was Yehuda who went into himself. Yehuda's last lines, I can't do this to my father. My father will die. I can't let this happen. And therefore, this moment, the businessman part, that practical part of Yehuda, cracks. And he speaks about his existential love for his father. He speaks about how important Benjamin is. Take me. And at that point, this tough, tough man, this tough vizier, he breaks in the same way. And as they break, they meet. Yehuda's a very brave man. He gets out of the circle of victimhood. He seizes the narrative. He comes up against Yosef, and he comes up as an equal, and he's ready to clash. He goes, and he takes the strongest form that he has, which is of being the practical man, and speaks practically. But then he finds something even stronger, to go within himself and to find the love and to seize that love and to be able to speak not only truth to power, but love to power, about love. And at that moment, Yosef himself cracks. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Thanks for tuning in. And we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.